As long as I match it, then that's fine. Okay, that's fine. Where you are right now. Yeah. All right, as long as I stay the same, because it's hard, like, post-production to edit all that stuff. Yeah. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast, and I am here with Jennifer Mitchell. Thank you for joining us.
I'm honored. Thank you for having me.
I would say Miss Mitchell. So some context, which I still, whenever I tell my wife anything about you, I refer to you as Miss Mitchell. And even my neighbor, when I'd be talking, I'd say Miss Mitchell. And so the context is that Miss/Jennifer was my favorite teacher in high school, my journalism teacher. And this would have been in 2003, 2004. And as we record this, it's in December of 2018. So it's been a long time. And the reason that I wanted to have you on now is that all those years removed from being a teacher, you went to BYU, right?
For grad school.
Correct. Where did you go for undergrad?
UW. University of Washington.
Oh, awesome. Okay. So all these years removed from teaching, and you are no longer in teaching, and now you're like a Shark Tank, but yoga is how I
see it.
Sure. Okay. I started going to classes last summer. I went for a month or a couple
yoga
of months.
Classes.
Yoga classes, mm-hmm. Kundalini yoga classes. And I would go every Sunday morning, and it was something completely different. And this was very shortly after I found Dr. Sarno's work, and come to find out that you were aware of his work and that kind of thing. And as the time has gone on, I've started thinking much more about meditation. It's something I do regularly, and it's something that recently a lot of guests have talked a lot about. So your expertise today will be a lot around, I want to talk meditation, I want to talk breathing, I want to talk the value of yoga. And there was actually a quote that I want to start with that you said in a class last year, and you may not even remember
this.
Oh
boy, really? Okay.
But there was something where you were talking about, and I can't remember the exact context, but the idea was essentially there needs to come a time where you sort of look around at your crew or your group of people that you're wanting to fix you, mm-hmm. and realize that like they can't fix you. And that quote's like been burned in my brain for so long. But I guess elaborate on what that means to you in this profession.
Well, first of all, I want to clarify that quote because I think folks that are just beginning their path of healing and self-inquiry can really benefit from a team of advisors or a one advisor or two advisors. So I don't want to kind of poo-poo this idea of going out there and getting help and asking for help, essentially. I think the problem comes where we start relying on outside sources to help us feel better too much, because, mm-hmm. you know, it's an inside job, right? We can ask for help and get input, but ultimately we have to sit down and do the work. And what I mean by do the work is, for me personally, you know, I had been out running pain and trauma all my life. You know, I mean, I pretty much made it a full-time job to either avoid it or manipulate it somehow to work for me. So, and I certainly can't say that I'm, you know, healed or even partially halfway there, really.
Yeah.
It's an ongoing thing. But what really tipped the switch in favor of being a little bit more aware and feeling a little bit more better in my body is sitting with discomfort. And feeling discomfort and facing discomfort and letting that be my initial route to healing and kind of getting underneath what that which, is keeping me suffering, essentially.
So to clarify, when you're talking about sitting with discomfort, are you talking emotional discomfort? Are you talking physical discomfort, or are they one and the same?
Well, in my experience, they're one and the same,
okay.
Both for my own, in my own mind and body, and for many of the people I work with at my studio, or studios,
yeah.
Now, you know, the mind and the body in my experience are totally connected.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, physical pain in my experience, unexplained physical pain, like soft tissue muscular pain that no one can really figure out. There's not a direct like, hey, your arm is broken or you've got a ripped tendon. In my experience, is so often the result of unhealed stress,
mm-hmm.
or stress that you've not yet stress that you're not yet attending to, essentially. So you're holding really tight in your body, which is creating all sorts of pulling and pain.
Yeah,
essentially.
Yeah. Now, how long have you been doing, like a practitioner of, not necessarily a teacher, but a practitioner of yoga.
Of yoga.
Yep.
20 years practicing yoga, mm-hmm. Or so, late 90s is when I started. But back then, I kind of fell into it because I was a group exercise teacher at the gym. So it was very physical based.
Like jazzercise?
Totally. Totally. You know, Eddie, I'm not that much older than you.
I'm going to be 33 in a couple of months.
I think about it though. When I was your teacher, I was, you know what, 29 or something, and you were 17, 18. Mm-hmm. So it seems like a big age gap when it's 17 to 29, but it's, you know, whatever. It's
right.
10 years. Yeah. Or right. So.
Exactly.
But it's so funny. I understand the need to call me Miss Mitchell. I mean,
it's honestly just, if you were not ever my teacher, then it'd be right. Totally different. It's no. Just that conditioning.
I get it. I taught high school for 18, 20 years. And at one time I came across a man who was a substitute teacher in my hallway who was a teacher of mine in high school.
Oh, okay.
And I went right back into like, oh, hi, Mr. Stan. How's it going?
I was going to ask if it was Mr. Goodman, but no.
No, it was Mr. Stan. And, you know, I went right back into high school. I yep. just couldn't call. I mean, this is a colleague of mine.
Right.
It's hilarious. So anyway, what I meant by that quote is, you know, we tend to want to avoid our own pain by putting the responsibility for healing on somebody else. So that means, you know, hiring, you know, a team. I've had a team of, you know, massage therapists, chiropractor, acupuncturist, therapists, physical therapists. And while they can help and send you on your way, what I found the most healing was, you know, going to India and spending 2 weeks meditating at the bottom of a river valley where I cannot get away from anything.
Yeah.
There's no distractions.
Right.
And so you come back from an experience like that profoundly changed.
So the reason I asked about how long ago starting yoga is that, so there's something that Sarno talks a lot about, this concept called the age of responsibility, basically. And that a lot of the people that he would have come into his office with these debilitating, in many cases, crippling chronic pain, where it was this weird, like between the ages of 30 and 50, sometimes 30 and 60. But he would see this interesting drop off of back pain incidents for people after they basically, like once they hit retirement or when their kids move out, or like where it would seem that if it truly was about spinal degeneration or even degeneration in general, that the chart would keep going, the line graph would keep going up, but that's just not how it is. And so you had started yoga in your 20s. I guess what was the reason? Was it just like, you know, because a lot of people.
Yeah, back to that. See, yeah. I tend to go off on all sorts of.
That's okay.
So you're going to have to rein me in. So anyway, I started yoga because I was teaching, not jazzercise, Eddie. I was teaching spinning.
Oh, cool.
And
okay.
So I taught spinning 6 or 7 classes a week, you know, hunched over a mm-hmm. bike. And, you know, the front body tends to get really short
yeah.
when you're spending a lot of time on a bike. And the class after me at the gym was yoga. And I'd always kind of been of this kind of science mind that, you know, there was no room in my mind for the unexplained. Right. So if I can't explain it, it doesn't exist. So yoga was always kind of this woo woo, like mm-hmm. whatever. You know, I grew up in the 70s. So it was weird in the 70s.
Yeah.
So I'd always had this kind of idea around yoga. Well, that's bullshit. I don't have time to stretch, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
And finally, the teacher after me talked me into coming to one of her classes. And for whatever reason, maybe it was my codependency, I said, I didn't want to be there.
Yeah.
So I said, fine, sure, I'll do that. And I felt terrific after class. And it took me, you know, it was physically, I felt terrific because I'd stretched myself out. In hindsight, I realized I felt better energetically mm-hmm. and in the mind, but I wasn't yet ready to name that, I don't think.
Yeah.
So I spent the first 10 years or so in my, more than that, 12 years or so, through the first couple years of owning this yoga studio, really having yoga being a physical practice, kind of after that elusive yoga body.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted the triceps and the yoga butt and all of those cute things. And then when it became clear I wasn't going to get that, I was like, well, I might as well work on my mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, the mind work kind of sneaks up on you. Magic started to happen in my mind. I started to feel better energetically and in my mind without intending to. So without going after that, I started to feel better. So then I thought, what's this all about? So then the last really 4 or 5 years have been, you know, I still do physical practice, but, you know, I'm more like, I like to walk my dog and do gentle yoga and meditate
yeah.
and do my meditation. And that's where my practice is now. So
meditation's interesting because I I think that a lot of people just, like, everybody sort of thinks that they suck at it. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the problem is sitting, like, I've tried, I use an app now that I think helps rein me in a little mm-hmm. bit, because when it would just sort of be me trying to be silent in a room, A, it's very hard in this house with two young kids and a wife and a cat and and the dogs and all that kind of stuff. It's just like my mind can just go, it gets easily distracted. But
yeah, it's boring too.
It's boring, right? Yeah. So the only thing naturally that can sort of come into awareness for somebody that doesn't practice it a lot is really like, what are the problems in your life? And then you kind of you start thinking about all that stuff and it just kind of manifests. So I guess, like, how did you get quote unquote good at meditation, and like, what are people missing, and maybe, like, are people overthinking it?
Well, some days it's miserable. Mm-hmm. You know, not every day do I sit down and meditate and go, this is amazing. Some days it's miserable, some days it's tolerable, some days I have a terrific experience, and usually when I'm not going after that terrific experience is when I have a terrific experience. So when you think about kind of what kind of your classic definition of meditation is like, you know, monk on a hill sitting quietly, mind empty, right?
Yeah.
And so we try to recreate that experience in our living room, and we fail at it because it's hard to sit down in 2018 in this society and quiet our mind. So we fail at it, and I don't know, raise your hand. Do you like to return to things you fail at?
No.
So, right? So we're not good at it. Mm-hmm. And so, oh, I know I can't meditate. And my mind just goes insane when you meditate. And really, your mind is insane all the time. The quieting of it, or the attempt to quiet it, is what tells you it's insane, right? It's insane all the time. We're neurotic and psychotic all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So in my meditation practice, what I've come to realize that works for me, the sit down and be quiet meditation doesn't work for me personally. Not yet, at least. Mm-hmm. It might in the future. I don't know. I've found that I have so much built up tension and stress and trauma in my body that I need to do a lot of physical movement prior to sitting, and a lot of breath work prior to sitting, which is, I found it in Kundalini yoga. And I had been practicing, you know, hatha yoga, asana yoga, for 18 years before I found Kundalini yoga. And it's just a different style of yoga that helps me personally, and a lot of people that I work with, kind of get the crazy out of your body so that you can now feel comfortable sitting with yourself.
I remember messaging you a couple weeks before I went to a Kundalini class, and I kept getting these, it was almost like you were, I don't know if warning's the right word, but you kept saying things along the lines of, like, this is going to seem kind of weird if you're uncomfortable. it was like a very, like, nurturing tone though.
I like to set the bar real low. Yeah.
And I remember I finished the first class and I turned to Chelsea, my neighbor who came with me, and I was like, she made it seem like it was going to be so weird and so awkward and so different. I'm like, I didn't get that feeling at all. But I imagine you probably do get people that do come in and maybe they think that, like, the breath of fire thing is just too much for them, or
it's weird. It can be weird.
And is it like, I remember when I finished shortly after, I had messaged a friend of mine who's a massage therapist. She had told me years ago that sometimes she'll be working on somebody and they'll suddenly get like an emotional release. Like, they just flip out, start crying or get angry or things like that. I would imagine that in, like, Kundalini work, that has that happened? Is that prevalent? Like,
all the time.
All the time.
Yeah. With my own personal practice, I've lost my mind in both asana classes, but more in Kundalini class. I see it with the people that come take class. But that's not to say if you don't, you know, break down and have an emotional release, you're doing it wrong, right? Yeah. I think sometimes we kind of look for that, you know, one-stop fix, like, oh, this is going to be my emotional release. Now I'm done. Now I'm fixed, right? Yeah. And what I have come to realize now, you know, I'm 48 years old, so I might be a little older than you, but I've come to realize, I kept, you know, in my earlier years, looking for this kind of proverbial line I would cross or I would achieve where I would feel fixed.
Right.
Right. So all good. We're good now, you know, and I would do these kind of grand, you know, all or nothing things. I would, you know, go to India for 2 weeks of the year. And then for the other 50 weeks a year, I was a neurotic mess, not sitting in my, you know, not doing my meditations in the morning. What was I talking about?
Basically, that there's like a line that people may expect to get to.
Oh, yeah. So if you do have an emotional release, that's great. But really 90%, 95% of the work is slow, steady slogging that is not, did you feel better after, did you feel good after those meditation classes?
I felt relaxed, but a lot of times, as you recall, I would finish the class, I'd go right home and I would turn on heavy metal music and I would start lifting weights. Right.
So maybe that's your meditation.
So, and I, one thing that I had always thought about, and the reason that all my pains and aches for that hell of 18 months that never equated to me was, why am I in so much pain at rest? And yet when I'm doing physical activity, I feel none. And that didn't make any sense to me. And sometimes chiropractors would say, oh, well, your fascia is nice and warm and that's why you don't fit. And as time has gone on, my thought is, no, like the internal chatter is gone. Like when I'm doing, mm-hmm. when I'm setting up for a heavy squat or something like that, like what I'm focused on is the task at hand. I'm not thinking about my one-on-one with my boss coming up in 3 hours. Like to me, and that, if you would have told me that 2 years ago, it never would have made any sense. But right. Like now that makes a lot of sense. And the concept of the line that you're talking about, Dr. Sarno talked a lot in his life about something called the reservoir of rage, and I call it the beaker of life, but it's the same idea where it's it's like, you know, you have this can, and I'm holding a LaCroix can, and it is, you know, it's absolute, like most people, they're filling it up. And, you know, it's like stresses of a job, and you had a kid and a sick dog and a car that won't start and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And eventually, like, it spills over, and that spillover is back pain, or that spillover is depression, or it depends on the person, like what it could be. So I think what you're describing is like this sudden line where you can cross it and everything goes away. When really, I think it's more of a checks and balances where it's like 2 weeks in India, you're removing maybe 40% of the tension.
Yes.
And it can kind of get you by for, you know, a certain amount of time. But if you don't continue to have a practice, you'll have problems. Yes. I had a close friend of mine who passed away of brain cancer the night before Audrey was born on January 11th of this year.
That's
and
intense.
I remember like I hadn't, the last time I can remember crying, like weeping, was 12 years ago, 11 years ago. But I, 45 minutes, like Jenny was like holding me and consoling me, and I couldn't stop, like could not stop. I was like the most blubbering baby that there could be. But there was 3 weeks where I had zero tension in my body. It was almost like, you know, you relieve all of that big release. Like, unfortunately, Chris passing away gave me a tremendous gift where it was like, there's no more proof in the pudding than that.
Yeah.
Where all this stuff goes.
That's
away.
Where the magic starts happening. And then you can't help but start to believe, mm-hmm. right? Because I suspect you were a pretty kind of concrete, sequential thinker. You know, if I don't have proof, it doesn't exist, et cetera.
My mom's a scientist.
Yeah. Oh, well, you didn't have any chance. yeah, right. So, the universe, God, whatever you want to call it, starts to prove you wrong.
Right.
For me, you know, your meditation, your, you know, pain relief can be the weightlifting. For me, you know, in Kundalini yoga, we ask ourselves and of our students to put our arms or our legs or do repetitive motions in particular patterning for extended lengths of time. So like 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 7 minutes, 9 minutes. And, you know, it can either be the best 3 minutes of your life or the worst 3 minutes mm-hmm. of your life, because at least in my experience, when you hold your arms in a certain angle in a certain position, all of your familiar pain pathways start showing up. So all of your areas of tension, all the little adhesions and stuck energetics that you have, say in your trapezius muscle or your jaw or your neck, start to fire and it starts to burn. And this is your opportunity for meditation. Do you want to let your pain control you, or do you want to control your pain? So for me, when I go straight into that pain and hold it, even though I don't want to be there, this is not fun. You know, what I want to do is throw my arms down and say, fuck you, which is the equivalent of letting yourself have it.
Yeah.
Right. When I go through that, when I'm done, the pain is gone because I've faced that pain head on and I've told that pain who's boss. Rather than turning, oh no, I've got this thing on my shoulder, I can't, you know, and that is the messaging of most healers, or many healers, I should say, is, you know, rest it, take care of it. There's, you know, great value in rest for sure, but rest it, take care of it, don't use it, don't move it. So it goes atrophy.
Yep.
So then your pain then starts controlling your movements rather than the other way around. We are very powerful beings. We have the control to heal ourselves. We have the ability to heal ourselves. And when you think about it, there is a lot of money to be had in keeping us sick.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's no motivation to heal. You know, there's some really well-meaning healers out there and really amazing healers out there, but we're set up in a society to seek contentment and seek wellness outside of ourselves.
So that brings up an interesting point. And if you don't want to answer or address this, that's fine. But someone that you were close to is in the medical industry.
Right.
It's a little different because this person works with kids, and I feel like that's not, I don't want to say off limits, but it's very different than, like, I go into Edmonds Family Medicine and they tell me I have C. diff, which was a really odd diagnosis I was given early on. It's what people get on cruise ships. Like,
really?
I was like, I haven't been on a cruise ship, and they said, well, we're going to test your blood, but you should probably get on these antibiotics, because I was getting the flu like once every other week. Mm-hmm. And they just couldn't crack that. And so I guess, like, how do you resolve that statement of, like, there is money to be had in the medical establishment, but being so close to somebody who is in the medical establishment, like, is that a conflict in your mind, or even between the two of you?
Yes.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It is a conflict that is we often avoid.
Mm-hmm.
And because he has his training and his belief and his experiences that tell him his training, belief, and experiences are correct in the right way. And I have mine, mm-hmm. obviously. It's something that it's really hard to be in relationship with someone who has totally different viewpoints around health.
Yeah.
You know, I'm this kind of organic, you know, I don't use artificial scents anywhere in my house and only eat organic food and, you know, believe in food as medicine and breath work as medicine and mind body medicine. And while he subscribes to some of that, I mean, he's certainly not the worst of allopathic physicians I've ever met.
Yeah.
You know, his training, I don't think he feels this way, but I'm projecting on him. All of his training and his life's work would start to feel like a lie.
Yep.
If he was open to this information.
Which I understand. Like, I empathize with, I'm involved in a lot of these forums and communities of people that have TMS or chronic pain or whatever you want to call it. And there's kind of a continual rhetoric around, they're only in it for the money. Doctors are only, and I'm like, mm-hmm. look guys, like, here's the thing. If you spent 8 years, 10 years, 12 years,
what is that?
It's one of the animals making noise. I don't know which one.
Your cat scratching the claws.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. I think, like, it would be tough for anybody to say, no, this thing doesn't exist and just accept it the way it is. One thing I do find interesting is I've interviewed three medical doctors, one internal medicine, one spine surgeon, and one sports medicine, basically, is what you would call them. And these are all people who were 100% in the medical Western model that we're talking about. And I'd say two of them are now 70-30 mind body, and the other one's like 95-5. And for them, it didn't necessarily take away everything they learned about, you know, musculoskeletal pain, but really just sort of revised the way to which they treat, like, mm-hmm. trauma and injuries that are lasting 0 to 8 weeks are treated a certain way. And then everything beyond that, chronic pain, is treated a completely different way, which seems to be more of a neural pathway problem than it is a, you know, if I have tennis elbow for 3 years, it's just because of an old injury, when really, like, that might not even really be a thing. It's probably a learned neural pathway. You're repressing something, and once you address it, whatever mode that is, whether it's...
And then you're eating sugar and food that creates more inflammation and, you know, a whole host of things, I think.
Right, yeah, and a lot of this stuff can be cumulative, and I know, like... I mean, I've interviewed people that are nutritionists on this show, and the reason I got so into the meditation thing, and pretty much right when I said I need to interview you, there was a guy several weeks ago who I interviewed. He's my favorite recovery story of all time, but, you know, kind of the doctor typical thing of, you've got all these herniated discs and you've got all these certain issues, and he had been in pain for, I don't know, 20 years, something like that, like terrible 7 or 8 out of 10 on the pain scale a lot of times. And he went and did meditation on a, he said he's been a meditation practitioner for 10 or 15 years. It didn't make much of a difference for him. But once he learned about Dr. Sarno's work and the concept that your body could be manifesting physiological symptoms based on a problem that's in your mind, he was doing a meditation session on his, like a back porch or something like that. And he said all that pain, like it's almost like his awareness went right to his mid-low back where it was always having all these problems. And then it just vanished. Like it's just completely went away. And now the more that I look for those stories, the more that I find them. But anecdotally, when you've worked with people for the last 20 years, teaching and even just maybe friends or colleagues of yours, like, are there instances of that where somebody's gone from being pretty debilitated and in a lot of pain to going through meditation or yoga or any one of these practices and being pretty darn relieved, if not completely relieved?
Yes. I mean, I've seen that in my own body. I've seen that in your body. I've seen that in, you know, many people I work with. I've also seen it not help. And you think about this gentleman you're talking about being on the back porch, you know, I can't say that I would know what happened there, but likely it wasn't just the one-off, right? Mm-hmm. It was, you know, however many years of trying and thinking, oh, this does nothing for me, and making baby steps, maybe even subconsciously, then one day sits down and it works, it helps. And I just wanted to circle back to that, the medicine is, you know, there are many, many well-meaning doctors and people in the medical field that I know are definitely not in it for the money. The person I have a relationship with is an academic medicine, you know, he works with kids. So how do you resolve this idea of physical ailments in a 3-year-old, right? That, I mean, maybe there's some subconscious stuff going on. Mm-hmm. So just want to clarify that because there's, like in all professions, there's ones with integrity and ones without.
Yeah.
But, you know, I personally, the Western allopathic model doesn't work for me personally. I'd go there if I had a, you know, broken bone.
Mm-hmm.
I see a functional medicine doctor myself who is actually an internal MD. She's an internal medicine, but I pair that with my own nutrition and my own healing. And like you learned, no one's going to heal you, Eddie. Mm-hmm. You have to heal yourself.
Brings up an interesting question. It's kind of veering off the path, but just because you said that. So let's say that you're stranded on a desert island. You got to pick two types of practitioners that are, it could be like a chiropractor and a whatever, right? Like, let's say even a yoga teacher would count. Mm-hmm. For me, I picked a massage therapist and a shrink, basically, is who I picked. But like, you know, for you, years sort of going from one model to the next and these changes that have happened over the last 20 or 25 years in your life, I guess, what would you say?
Probably a really good Kundalini yoga teacher. And massage therapy feels good at the time for me, but I am not experiencing any more lasting healing from a massage therapist. I am really loving Bowen work these days.
Oh, interesting. What is that?
It's a body work that no one knows how it works. It works on your nervous system. Mm-hmm. Boy, I'd love it if you could get a Bowen work practitioner on here. I found a lot of relief with that. And I work with a massage therapist who actually does Thai yoga. So she does yoga on me, which I really, I feel good for days after.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two things I would choose. That's something really, back at the medical industry, since we're talking about stress and pain associated with stress, you know, 4 years and years studying yoga and meditation and mindfulness, you know, we've kind of accepted this idea that the stress response is fight or flight, right? You've come to think.
Oh, yep.
Yeah, right. Fight or flight. Hi, kitty. Cat wants to be part of this conversation. Oh, you're such a little, these cats are just like monks.
Oh, yeah.
Hi. So, you know, I had, and for so many years, decades really, accepted that as true. And I think there is some truth to that and a lot of truth to that. And when I hear it, yes, that's the basic thing. And I would also teach it when I was doing yoga teacher training. Very recently, 6 months ago or so, I've come to find out that the original study done for pain or stress response in fight or flight was a study in, I think, the 30s at Harvard University, conducted by a male, white man, of course, mm-hmm. and his subjects were white men. So he wasn't studying women, people of color, people in the margins,
yep.
where fight or flight is a luxury, right? It's not an option.
Mm-hmm.
So when we start to look at, like I start to look at my stress response, and certainly there is an element of fight or flight there, but also there's a third element that's it's a broad umbrella, which is called tend and befriend. So you think about women or people in the margins, like for example, like if you're going to go back to caveman days, right? So the big strong men cavemen, they have the ability to fight or flight. Right. Mm-hmm. So they can run fast, or they're stronger than women. And there's a chance that you could, you know, win in a saber-toothed tiger fight. unlikely. But, you know, there's an option too. And you think about the women in that situation, you know, with a baby on a hip and a baby on the boob. There's no running there and there's no fighting there.
Yep.
So women have to create their own way of coping, which can have elements of certainly a fight or flight, but women in general throughout history have created methods of coping by, you know, making friends and soothing and trying to create a harmonious home where there's tension or stress. So there's a whole nother level. It's not just fight or flight.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this points to two things. A, it's not just fight or flight. These are not the only two options. And B, you know, the medical industry historically has done women and people in the margins a terrific disservice in the, you know, medical studies are mostly done on white men or historically been, you know, in the 20th century for sure. You know, there certainly was some, you know, horrific medical studies done on, you know, prisoners and experiments done on, you know, people in psych wards in the 20th century. And people of color and in the margins. But for the most part, most legitimate medicine has been done on white men. So you get to today and you start like looking at women's rage, for example.
I voted for that book, by the way.
You did.
When you put the poll on Instagram. I know like 80% of people voted on the Michelle Obama book, which I would have too if I didn't do this podcast and I didn't talk about rage all the time.
Right.
That's why I picked what I picked. So hopefully you'll get to that soon.
I will, yeah. So Eddie is talking about, I had two books. I put it on my Instagram stories. Which one should I start? And one was the Michelle Obama mm-hmm. and one was Rage Becomes Her.
Yeah.
History of Women's Anger. So we as a society have historically told women that it's not okay to be angry. You don't have the option to fight. Right. And that's been the message to women for eons. Right. Take the injustice and handle it. And if you handle it and you can't get mad. And if you do get mad, there's going to be consequences. And if there is consequences, you better be the one that fixes it. So when we talk about stress response between men and women, it's totally different.
Mm-hmm.
But up until recently, in my experience, and for many, I'm sure probably people listening to this podcast are hearing this information for the first time, we've accepted the fact that there is a model for stress response that applies to everyone, period. And you look at, you know, disabled people, fight or flight is not an option. So we develop, you know, they would develop all sorts of different coping mechanisms to deal with stress that don't have anything to do with fighting or flighting.
So my thought on TMS and this work, it actually for me revolves far more in the freeze response, mm-hmm. Which in a lot of ways is like, I feel stuck in this situation. I feel stuck because I have a kid on one hip and a kid on the boob and I can't do anything about my situation. That's just the way that it is. And so repress, 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 mm-hmm. and things become problematic. It's interesting that you talk about this being white males being a part of the study as opposed to people in the margins or people in minorities, things like that. I did a whole episode on this, which by the way, you can go back and find this in the archives, but the ACE study episode that I did, are you familiar with the ACE study?
No, but I'll listen now.
So it's the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, which essentially gauge, I think it's 10 questions, but it asks you, did you experience, for instance, did you experience a house where one parent or somebody in the family went to prison. Like there's, and essentially if you have a yes seven times or more, might even be four or more to these questions, you become 20 times more likely to develop emphysema. You become 20 times more likely to die 20 years sooner. So like there was a part in that movie that we went and saw, All the Rage, the movie about Sarno, where there was an entire section that was about chronic pain and chronic illnesses developing in places where there's a lot of poverty and there are a lot of minorities. And it's very interesting that like that this is a thing, because it there isn't a choice, and you maybe you're sort of stuck in there a lot of times. And I think that the disability, the bringing that up is interesting too, because for 3 years, if before I got into tech, I worked with kids primarily, but a lot of adults with neuromuscular disease, ALS, and Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Life expectancy is very, very short. I think the seventh or eighth child that I went to summer camp with just passed away. And he was 25, 26, something like that, which is pretty long for what he had. But I feel like I've seen a lot of studies around like life satisfaction of people that are in wheelchairs versus people that are not. And it's almost like I know it's very tough to say, and it's very like for me to turn back and say like, Eddie, what have you been so upset about? Yeah, right.
Watch your privilege.
Exactly. Right. But like, trauma is one of those things I think that like it's totally up to the person. Like my wife, as an example, if I've reacted the way that I have to life, which means like causing my own internal pain, and the way that I've interpreted events as traumatic, which other people would look at and say, that's not traumatic at all, that doesn't hold any merit, but it's all to the person that it's happening to. So like Jenny, for instance, I almost feel like, okay, like I got all the back pain, I got all the neck pain, and like for what I've had in my life, I feel like I've had it pretty good, right? Like she has not had it as good, and yet you know, everything, all the ducks seem to be in a row and the health is there and all that. So I think for the people that sort of grew up in those types of environments, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just calibrated differently, I guess, is the way that system works, and how often you're hyped up and sympathetic versus parasympathetic.
Right. Well, I mean, it's hard to be human in general, no matter where you lie in that continuum. But certainly, and I'm no pro at this, I've just started to really kind of take a look at my privilege and my biases and my lack of awareness. I cringe at some of the things I've said and done around that. Like, oh God, so entitled. You know, certainly people that are living way in the margins, people of color, you know, they don't have luxury to get angry in public.
Yeah.
You know, I guess we don't need to go down that road. But, you know, when you're not getting your basic needs met, that's trauma. When you are getting your basic needs met, but your parents are fighting, that's still trauma. You know, trauma is... it's all relative. So I, you know, while we do kind of like, oh God, I haven't had it that bad. You know, I don't think it's a good idea to poo-poo anyone's trauma, because right. It's all real. And it all, listen, anger or emotions, you know, it's not going to magically disappear in your mind or your body. You know, when it comes in and when you feel it, you either need to do something with it to process, right? For whatever tools you have available to you. For me, it's Kundalini yoga. Or you're going to take it out on somebody else or something, or most likely you're going to turn on yourself. Mm-hmm. So are we going to talk about the breath? And this is what I brought.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's certain. There's I want to get into the breath part of it. And I also want to ask about, I'll come back to
it. You know, we could be here for 3 hours.
I know, I was just going to say, we're already at 40 minutes, and I'm like making an internal list of things that we're going to keep talking about. But
no, this is really good stuff. It's really interesting stuff. And it all points to chronic pain and suffering, essentially. This is going to be a hard one to edit for you.
I don't, everything that we've talked about will air as long as it's been, like, I don't do really any post-production. Oh, okay. I take the bass out of my own voice, and that's the only work really? I do in post. Oh. It sometimes, if you have bass up, what kind of car do you drive? You drive a Prius.
Oh, please. I don't have bass in my Prius.
I was going to say, for people with a lot of bass in their cars, like mine has a lot of bass in it. I either have to turn the bass way down, or I just have to make the edits, and I have to assume there's got to be people out there that have that same problem.
Yeah, so I'm just another idiot in Prius.
My wife and I always, we we talk about Prius drivers a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know if you act like the, I mean, are you driving in the left-hand lane going 55?
No. Okay. So that see? Just makes me crazy.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So totally. Let's get
That's
into
a Pacific Northwest trait, by the way. Nowhere else in the country you go. And
I don't know. So Stone Cold Steve Austin, my man, lives in Marina Del Rey, California, the Orange County area. And he is always, we call them cutting promos, but really it just means he's yelling at somebody that's driving a Prius, but on his podcast, like telling a story. I feel like it's twice a week he's probably doing it, talking about a Prius driver stuck in the left-hand lane in California. So yeah. It does exist elsewhere.
Okay.
Okay. So the breath part of this, which is really when I had dragged you on here, I had said, I want to talk about the breathing part of it because it's another one of those things. I got a message on LinkedIn from a guy yesterday. He's a professional dude. Some people find me like this too, where it's like a professional dude on a professional social networking website and says, hey man, I listen to your podcast all the time and you talked about breathing recently. Can you expand on it a bit? Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, well, it's just perfect because I'm talking to Miss/Jen Mitchell tomorrow. So talk to me about like what's going on physiologically with a breathing practice. You had mentioned earlier, in order for you to really sort of get in the zone with meditation, you need to spend some prep breath work.
Mm-hmm. For me.
For you.
That's my experience. I can't just plop down mm-hmm. and be like, you know, there's some people that get out of bed in the morning and just sit right down on their meditation cushion, close their eyes and still their mind. And by the way, they're not stilling their mind. You know, there's brain waves, there's thoughts going on.
Yep.
They're just not attaching.
Right.
The people that are, you know, meditating in quotes are not, they're just not, that's what meditation is. You know, we fail at meditation because we have an incorrect perception of what meditation is. And for some, it's a blank mind, but that is very difficult a state to achieve because yep. the mind's job is to work. It needs a job. Mm-hmm. So if you're not going to give the mind something to do, it will do something on its own. So that's, in my opinion, what meditation is, you know, center the mind, focus the mind. You might have thoughts that spring off in all directions, but are you going to follow them? Are you going to start problem solving? Do you find yourself a million miles away? When you do, you bring it back to where are you present moment. And sometimes when I sit and I, you know, try to meditate, I can last maybe a second or two before I'm off on my tangent.
Yeah.
The problem is that when you're trying to meditate and you're finding yourself failing, you look at people who are meditating and you compare their outsides to your insides. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at this person that looks peaceful on the outside. You don't know what's going on in their head.
Yep.
You could be totally faking it. But you're comparing what's going on in your head with what you think is going on in the other person's mind. And from the outside, it looks like nothing because they're still and they're peaceful and they're breathing and, you know, they've got their yoga gear on and they're sitting on a pretty cushion and, you know, incense is whatever. They've got the whole thing. So just you know, when you meditate, just, you know, be gentle with yourself. You know, you don't have to get it right all the time.
Well, so you had mentioned like you notice your mind drifting and then you sort of bring it back.
All the time.
So I feel like the phrase that I hear a lot with some of the guided meditations that I do is if your mind does wander, bring it back to the breath.
Yeah, but how boring is that?
Right, how boring is that? Like, right. Like for me, like I Sunday morning I went. Jenny was like, "Can you go pick up my Starbucks?" And I was like, "Yeah, absolutely," because it's time for me to get the hell out of the house for a few minutes. So I go. I went down. Kind of by Francis Anderson Center by, you know,
you took the studio. Route to the farthest away Starbucks you could possibly get. You know, there's a Starbucks a block away from Eddie's house.
So I went
you had
down
to park, get out.
Right. Well, so I parked, right? So I go down to Francis Anderson, I park, and then I did a 10-minute meditation. It was probably the best one I've ever done. Meaning right. like when the timer was up at 10 minutes, I was sort of like, where the hell have I been for the last 10 minutes, right? And by the way, when I got home, she goes, "Did you go to the one in Bellingham?" Like, because it took me so long.
We women were on to you.
Yeah, totally. last night, I'm trying to do the exact same meditation, same guided one, same voice, all this kind of stuff. And I just couldn't get it. The end of 10 minutes happened, and I'm like, I got a million things I got to go do right now. Yeah, like, I just couldn't. Yeah. So I think it's so dependent on whatever it is that's going on in your conscious or your unconscious mind.
Sure.
So the bringing back to the breath part, because the breath thing is super interesting to me and a lot of people listening to this, and I get a ton of questions about it. So tell me about the importance of the breathing part.
Okay.
What should people be doing? Like, what is it? What's going on?
Okay, so there, first of all, there's no should.
Don't should all over yourself.
Yeah. So there is really, when we're talking about healing yourself, there's, in my opinion, there's really not one technique, idea, pill, activity that is more, that is easier, cheaper, more, most accessible than the breath. And you can think about it, the power of just sitting up wherever you are and letting your shoulders soften, relaxing your belly, and taking one really good quality breath in and out. You can, it's remarkable the difference between second to second, right? So we, you can see if you just, you know, maybe your listeners would be willing to do that right now. You know, just to sit up. Will you do that for me?
Yeah.
Just sit up, put your hands down, close your eyes. See if you can let your shoulders soften a little bit. And then take the biggest, richest breath you've taken yet today. Fill up. And then exhale. All right. There you go. That's it. That's all you got to do. Right? So difference between where you were kind of alert and leaning forward and kind of in this kind of alpha state. Mm-hmm. If you study, you know, brain waves and brain activity, you're in this alpha state of doing, and the ability to just sit back and sit up and take a breath can take you immediately to the next level of, I don't want to say take to the next level, because that creates this idea that you're increasing. Let's say drop to the a different frequency of brain waves, that where thoughts are happening not as quick.
So alpha brain waves are super interesting, because it's basically that, for anybody that doesn't know, an alpha brain wave, a good example of where it occurs is you're laying down in bed and you're sort of in that moment between falling asleep and like right before falling asleep. A lot of people might have, I don't know, I feel like maybe I have a 2-minute window, a 3-minute window. Some people, maybe it's longer, but that's very similar to that meditation on Sunday I was describing, where what just happened, how did I get here?
And as soon as you attach your mind to it, like if you're sitting and you start moving, you're like, oh, what was that?
Yep.
You're out of it.
Yep.
You've gone out of it. So your mind starts, then it bumps back up to the higher heightened level of brain waves. So we know that when you start taking a good quality breaths, all sorts of physical and physiological changes start happening, right? So your heart rate lowers, your blood pressure lowers, your pupils move from a dilated, super heightened state to a little bit bigger, or maybe it's the other way around, smaller. Your brain waves start, your brain starts moving into kind of a beta. What's it? How's it go? It goes gamma is the most heightened. Gamma, alpha, beta.
I was just actually looking at this the other night. If you can kill 20 seconds of time,
okay, I'll just keep talking. So, alpha, I think, or gamma is the most frenetic brain activity. And so, oh, by the way, in these brain waves, I've read this, and this is what I believe based on what I've read. I've accepted this as fact, but who knows? Maybe this study was done on all men. Maybe this is male brainwaves,
yeah,
and this doesn't have anything to do with women or people that are not white male.
So I just passed over to Jennifer the brainwaves, basically, like where it is that they occur. And this whole section of this book that I was reading was all about the alpha brain, like the desirable alpha state.
Yeah, from what I understand, so there's four brainwaves in this brainwave activity. So delta is the most heightened, the most thoughts are coming the quickest. Theta is where you start to go when you start to breathe. Alpha is kind of where you are when you're in meditation. Thoughts are far apart. When you do think, you're not taken, you know, you're not taken down on a wild brick, you know, wild carpet ride. And then beta are the brainwaves that are like, you know, the monks on the, that have been meditating for decades, yep, sitting on a mountain. So when you take 5 or 6 really good quality breaths, you can watch your brain activity if you're hooked up to all the waves, all the wires go from delta to theta. And this practice is available to you. It's free. No one has to administer it for you. You can do it anywhere, anytime. It's boring.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's not sexy. Society had, not yet anyway, mainstream society hasn't named it as the most effective way, right? The most effective way is delivered to us through Super Bowl ads for pharmaceuticals, yep, right? From and that's constant messaging that you must go out and buy something to feel better. So anyway, the breath helps to do all these things. So when also, so you're, when you are in a heightened state of stress, then like if your heart rate is elevated, if you're scared, if your brain is everywhere, if your muscles are tense and your blood pressure is up, your breath will follow suit. It will come short, choppy, shallow. So the good thing is that the breath is one of the few body functions that's both voluntary and involuntary. So most of the time it's voluntary, but we can, or involuntary, excuse me, but we can make it voluntary. So it's a two-way street. So we can tell our body to calm through our breath, just like our body tells our breath to get ragged. So it's just another example of the ways in which you can heal yourself.
What is, because my thought is like basically the more time, maybe to simplify, like the more time that you spend in an alpha state, probably the faster your parasympathetic system gets activated, or maybe the more dominant it is or something like that. I guess like how, if you were to make a recommendation to somebody to start a breathing practice, right? It's easy. I can sit in my living room or I can go to a park. I can, you know, how long per day would be a good, I think a lot of people have a problem starting
a minute
as part of the issue. Yeah.
Do a minute. That's yeah. It.
When I had my shoulder surgery a couple of years ago, the, cause I basically like, I had this shoulder surgery. I went through all the rehab the day before I got medically cleared for all activity was when my back spasms and my neck and all that stuff started acting up. But one of the things the initial physical therapist I saw, who was the same guy I worked with my shoulder, had told me the biggest part of my PT program he put me on was breath work. It was like,
which is free,
right? Exactly. Right. So he gave me like some thoracic spine exercises, things like that. And, but he said, you know, to be honest, I think the majority of this is a breathing issue.
Bravo for that PT.
Right. Exactly.
Working in the insurance PT model.
Right.
amazing.
Which it's interesting because when I had worked with him for several months trying to get all this stuff working again, and eventually he just kind of said like, I can't figure it out. And I had had like diagnosis for a variety of things like thoracic outlet syndrome and it's your neck and all these types of things. Neck surgery was recommended. Pec surgery was recommended.
Thank God you didn't do that.
Right. And I was searching for like mobility tools on Amazon, and that's how I came across Sarno's book. And I read it in two nights on the deck, and I even messaged that PT, and I was like, okay, I just read this book and it's kind of completely changed how I think about really all the stuff we've been working on, and kind of here's the genesis of it. And I just wrote out some stuff to him, and he goes, I expected him to say, and I'm watching like the dot, dot, dots, like I'm waiting for the message, and I'm expecting David to say like, you're crazy, I'll see you on Tuesday, whatever. And he said, this makes a lot of sense. And he got into this thing about how he's been trying to work on journaling and working on more meditation and things like that for himself. And he goes, this makes complete sense to me. And we'd been spending 3 days a week together for 7 months or 8 months or something going into this. So like he knew me pretty well. And I think that he knew that, you know, I would come in and I lost a deal at work or something, and I'm ramped up about this and I'm amped up about a kid. And then you find out you're going to have another kid. Like there's just a lot of stuff. You know what I mean?
It must have been, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. It was before you started hurting.
Getting hurt. Yeah.
Yeah. And you were really into lifting some heavy shit.
I think you saw me doing lunges on the side of Highway 104 once at Edmonds CrossFit, like years ago.
Yeah. But that's not what I was talking about. You posted a photograph of your trapezius muscles, mm-hmm. like you had the phone over a mirror selfie, yep. like basically, and they were gigantic.
Yeah.
You could see the tension in them. And the world says this is hot and sexy, but you could see the tension in them. Your muscle fibers weren't laying flat.
Yeah.
So I don't know why I brought that up.
It was like Thanos without the Infinity Stones.
Essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, we know that for the vast majority of people with chronic pain, the insurance model of physical therapy doesn't work, right? It can give you temporary relief. You can, you know, scrape out your fascia and stuff. But you know, as soon as you go back to your regular life and your regular thought patterns and regular body holding and coping mechanisms, clenching, that pain's just going to bound up right over again. I'm wishing for a revolution in physical therapy. I'm working with a woman right now, she works for me actually, who's a physical therapist and a yoga teacher. And in blessing of all blessings, she just got fired from her PT job where she was seeing patients, five patients an hour.
Wow.
Four or five patients an hour, insurance, and getting paid, by the way, $25 an hour. She has a PhD in physical therapy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just it's thankless work. The light's going out in her eyes. And we could talk a whole nother thing around dharma and working in doing work that you're not meant to do, mm-hmm. and how that can really be soul sucking and painful. But she just got laid off. And the reason was you don't fit in, because she wanted to spend time with people.
Right.
So her boss laid her off and said, you don't fit in. And that's caused problems in the past. So you're not going to work in this insurance model that we need you to. And we're going to go ahead and get rid of you so you don't cause problems. So luckily, I have a treatment room in my yoga studio that she's going to start seeing patients the way she wants to see patients.
Oh, cool.
She's not taking insurance. People want to work with her. They've got to commit to her, you know, including breath work and looking at your feeling your feelings. And I think that's another thing that's such a challenge about sitting down and starting breath work. A, it's boring.
Mm-hmm.
B, you start to, it's excruciating. I mean, who wants to sit alone with their mind, right? I mean, I heard something a while back that said, you know, my mind is like a dark alley. I don't want to go in there by myself.
Yeah.
Right? So we keep ourselves highly distracted with, you know, our phones and our TV and our life and our whatever we do on purpose. And that might be the only coping mechanism we have at any given time.
Well, I know that there's starting to be psychologists that are looking into what's the actual, like, the dopamine release when you see, for instance, like a notification from Facebook on your phone.
Oh, sure. 100%.
People care about me. Yeah. Right? And I think that that's actually, it's a perfect segue into the last thing that I wanted to talk to you about, which is, so you're a yoga teacher. We're talking about all this stuff. The world's changed a lot in the last 20, 25 years. And I find myself, even in the last year and a half, my parenting is very different with Zoe, the 4-year-old, and it's going to continue to be that way than it was a couple of years ago. I was thinking earlier, we were talking about, I forgot exactly what the story that we were coming about was, but basically, like, it used to be, if Zoe was really upset about something, whether I felt like it had merit or not, the goal was, stop, we got to get you to stop crying. Like, we got it, whether it's like you dropped something on your foot or somebody said something to you or somebody pinched you at school or like, you're upset because we're arguing about how you want mac and cheese and I want you to eat something else.
I want to be in control.
Right, exactly.
The dad,
right,
of a 4-year-old.
Right,
it's
exactly.
So funny,
right,
how we do that.
Exactly. Yeah. And Jenny and I talk about this a lot. And like, one thing that I've worked insanely hard on, and it hasn't been as hard as it sounds, like, now that I'm more in practice of it, but like, now when she's upset, my response to her is, it's okay to be upset. Let's talk about it. As opposed to, don't be upset, don't cry. Mm-hmm. And even though when I was saying don't be upset, don't cry, it's not that your feelings don't matter. It's that I think that the wrong thing at the time, like, the wrong thing is for you to cry. So,
right, but they receive it as, my feelings don't matter. Especially, I mean, you got to be, you know, real careful as a dad of girls, right? You're
right.
Sending some big messages.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So that has wildly evolved. And luckily, Audrey will grow up.
Thank you, Eddie, for doing that.
Luckily, like, Audrey will grow up her entire life because, you know, I had found all this stuff before she was born. So, but Zoe, you know, she walked in halfway in, right? So whatever damage I did between 0 and 2. So
stop. Give yourself a break. I mean, the world is conditioned. I mean, you were raised this way. How else would you know any different?
Right.
You know, I can tell you that growing up in my household, anger was not allowed, period. My dad, my mom had a terminal illness all of her life. She passed away when I was 18, but she was sick most of my life with a brain tumor. Finally, you should say that. And my dad, through his own, you know, traumas growing up, I mean, I can't even get into it, but lots of trauma, is unable to receive anger, let alone women's anger.
Right? Yeah.
So whenever I would get angry, he would just shut it down immediately. Like, you know, do the same things. Don't cry. Don't cry. Mm-hmm. Don't cry. It's kind of like this. We got to look at ourselves as parents. It hurts our ego a little bit,
yep,
even if it's subconsciously.
Yep.
And I can remember, even when my daughter was, you know, 2, crying, I remember her dad saying, don't cry, rocking her, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry. And that's some pretty big messaging.
Yep.
So, you know, therefore, you know, I'm pissed. Like, my anger is old. and deep. Mm-hmm. I find myself either as an adult or a younger adult, I was totally inequipped to handle anger. So I either said nothing and stuffed it or swung the other way and like word vomited, created a lot of damage.
Yeah.
There was no acceptable anger and there really still isn't. Even though we are making progress, it's just, it makes me so good to hear you say that. I appreciate that. But just look recently what happened to like the US Open, Serena Williams, mm-hmm. right? Serena Williams had its terrible, you know what I'm talking about? Terrible.
Well, I mean, by the way, that exact same incident has happened before with a male and it has not.
No, it's terrible like double that. Standard, right? And so, and she was punished deeply for that. And then later, because she got angry, right? So yep. She was punished badly. And then later, you know, all the 24-hour news channels, especially the conservative ones, you know, starting with the angry woman, the shrill, the angry. So we have, you know, thousands of years of conditioning to dig out from underneath that says women are not allowed to feel anger. And that's showing up as pain in our bodies.
Yeah. How do you feel like, and we're already, we've gone twice as long as I said I would.
Yeah, divide this one into two.
How, to wrap up, I guess like talk about, how old's your daughter?
She'll be 13 in a week.
Perfect age. Okay. So, how has a lot of the introspective work that you've talked about, how has that sort of evolved parenting for you?
Oh, poor girl.
Over the last few years? I mean, to me, like I've been gifted the present of giving more empathy to Zoe, and it's going to be the same way with Audrey and being more open with my wife. And like, so there has been a lot of things that maybe sometimes like they're a little bit rough. Like if I'm upset about something, I used to sort of bury it for a month and then I just wouldn't think about it again, when really like that's still brewing down, you know, down whatever.
Oh yeah. That's going to go somewhere.
Right. And so,
yeah, it's not going to just go away.
So Jenny now, like I don't yell and I don't, when I say the wrath, I don't mean the wrath, but like, me expressing how I feel about things now is happening a lot more rapidly. Instead of it being 6 months later after the event happened, now it might be a day or a couple of hours or whatever. So I guess talk a little
bit.
Can
I speak to that real quick?
Yeah.
So when you have, you know, you quote work on your communication, I think that's all really noble and wonderful. But if you're not getting to the heart of what's coming out within the communication, you end up just white knuckling it,
yeah.
Right? Like, oh, I can't yell, you know, and you end up just then stuffing it. So you, when you're not feeling your anger and working through your pain, for me, it's anger. For other people, it's sadness. For other people, it's fear.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is for you.
I think I thought a lot more like it's evolved in the very beginning. I thought it was more annoyance, right? Which is just a nice, like,
it's a nice way to say angry.
Right. Yeah. And then it was
socially acceptable way to say angry.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it became stress. And then the assumption was anger because that's so much of what Sarno talked about. And then as I started to think about it, I was like, no, there's a lot more sad here than there is angry.
I think, Thich Nhat Hanh, am I saying his name right? He has got this book on anger. And I read a quote about him that says anger usually has a friend. So it's usually paired with
something
fear,
else.
Sadness,
yep.
All of the above. So anyway, working on communication, I think, is amazing. But I think we need to go a step further and really kind of, again, I just keep coming back to sitting. We've got to revolutionize our relationships to things that suck, right? Because I mean, who here likes to feel uncomfortable? Nobody, right? So we avoid it or manipulate it. And to be able to, you know, I do my work on the yoga mat because it feels like a laboratory for life in a safe space. You know, I can create situations where I feel really uncomfortable in my movement. And then I get to watch my brain do its thing. I get to watch my brain go into its familiar patterning with like either avoid, write a story why I can't do it, or manipulate it somehow. Mm-hmm. And that's when you get to revolutionize your relationships to things that suck, so that when you get off the mat or you get out of the weight room or whatever you do, you're more apt or able to react or not react to things that are normally subconscious.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's what I had to say to that. What was your question? Where were you going with that?
Just about the evolution of your parenting over the last 12.9 years, how that's changed, and has there been some sort of a correlation between how kind of your meditation slash yoga practice has evolved and how you feel like parenting and relationships with your kid has evolved in that time.
Well, I'm going to start by saying it's really hard to be a parent. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to be human. So I spent a lot of my time in my head going, my God, don't let me fuck up this kid, right?
Yeah.
When I am not doing my meditation and my breathing practices, my Kundalini, regularly, I tend to, you know, go back to my subconscious patterning, but then my mind takes over and goes, oh my God, I shouldn't do that because it's not yogic, right? I shouldn't manipulate or control. I'm a huge manipulator and huge controller. You know, that's what helps me feel safe,
yeah,
right? So, you know, the other day we were decorating the Christmas tree and I was telling Claire, not so many words, that where she was putting the decorations weren't in the right. So thank right. God. I mean, and here I am like, ah, fuck, I know better,
yeah,
right? So, you know, and then, so when I'm not doing my meditation, like I think about it later going, oh, why did I, you know, I'll do yep. better next time kind of thing. But when I am doing my meditation, I simply don't have those asshole thoughts.
Yeah.
They just don't come up. And because my subconscious is, my nervous system is strong.
Chilled out.
Right. My nervous system is strong and I don't feel the need to control where my daughter puts the Christmas ornaments.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. Or whether or not she makes her lunch or acts in a certain way or, you know, it's. This controlling behavior that we do as parents, it's a strategy to help ourselves feel to help life be easier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what we realize is it creates so much. Yeah, it's we've got to laugh at it. So I can't tell you how my parenting has changed. She would tell you, she's like, oh God, not another lecture, right? Not another lecture on her feelings. So, you know, I think parent or kids tend to swing 180 degrees opposite from whatever their parents taught them,
yeah,
occasionally. And then yeah, maybe it sneaks in. So I don't know what kind of adult. My daughter's a great kid.
Yeah.
Maybe because I've been always so controlling in her entire life. She's kind of codependent. So she now does what I ask her to do.
Right.
It's, I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. I do the best I can.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are at an hour and 8 minutes. So I want to thank you for your time. And I'm sure there's a gazillion other things that.
We didn't even get to the yoga and breathing, really. It's crazy.
I mean, we got to the importance of yeah, meditation and breathing. And again, like going back to the beginning where I said a lot of people think they suck at it, which it sounds like you're in that boat, right? Like mm-hmm, I look at you as a evangelist of this stuff.
Right.
And you think that you're not great at it all times. Right, you know what I mean?
You're comparing my outsides with your insides.
So that, I think that is a great thing to wrap up with. And a lot of people listen to this, they're just like, I can't quiet my mind. It's like, well, like the person that's teaching it sometimes can't quiet their mind.
All the time.
And right. All the time. Yeah. And that's an important thing to bring home. So
only I would say the top, you know, 2 or 3% of meditators and intentional breathers. And by the way, breathing is a meditation, you know, the path to meditation comes through the breath.
Yeah.
So if you just simply sit on your floor and take 5 really good quality breaths, usually my mind wanders during those 5 breaths,
yeah,
you know, and then you're, and then there's another thing to beat yourself up over. Like I can't even sit and take 5 breaths.
Right.
Right. So you just gotta be gentle with yourself and know that your brain is made to think.
Yeah.
Your brain is made to keep you safe. And especially if you've experienced significant trauma over your lifetime, it's constantly thinking because that's its coping mechanism to keep you safe.
Yeah.
So you know, the brain is a tough opponent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even want to say opponent, but it's not an easy thing to come up against because, you know, we've got thousands of years of DNA conditioning.
Well, and it's really hard because the brain and the mind are literally the one thing you can't duplicate in a lab. So it's like we can predict how a labrum repair will react. We can predict how an ACL repair will react. We can predict how a femur break will react and how it will heal. But there's no way for you to duplicate what's going on in the mind, really, which is why I think neuroplasticity in general is so fascinating.
It's so interesting, isn't it? And if you can just sit down, you know, for 5 breaths, then maybe you start to become aware of your patterning, where you hold in your body, you know, big areas, the mm-hmm, butt, the navel, the belly, the jaw, the shoulders,
yep,
all of the above.
Yeah.
at given times. So, you know, just sitting quietly is a great tool for awareness, which is, it sounds like where your listeners are, really. We're at the first step. Do that for a couple of years, right?
And I think that just, I mean, as busy as everybody is, like 3 minutes a day, 5 minutes a day is better than nothing. And it's probably actually really, really good. Like 5 minutes of actual breath work is a lot.
That's a lot. That's a lot. That's about what I do, quite honestly, most days. Unless, you know, I'm at the bottom of a river valley in India.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have the luxury of an hour and a half meditation practice these days with parenting and work. And, you know, although I did, I have an app on my phone and about how much screen time I'm on. Mm-hmm. Do you have this?
Yes. The update tells me. Yeah. I got one last week and it said like 2 hours and 12 minutes. I was going, what?
I know. So if we didn't have the screen, we could have an hour and a half.
Yeah.
But you know what? That's the world we live in today.
Right.
You know, we kind of beat ourselves up for our screen time, but it's the world we live in today.
Yeah. Every few weeks I'll say, should I just get a flip phone again? And then I'm like, no.
It would be challenging to live life and work without a smartphone.
Right.
Right. I mean, you could do it, but. So.
All right. Jen, Miss Mitchell, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.